You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished fund manager Alexandra Jackson of Rathbone. So a big welcome, Alexandra.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, well, I'm absolutely delighted. Anyway, we've had a sort of ton of big macro data over the past few months, culminating in the markets now trading at roughly round about all-time highs. But before we sort of like dig through the sort of all your outlook for the rest of the year, I don't suppose you could quickly remind investors of what type of stocks you like.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I do like quite a specific type of stock. I spent my formative years in this industry working on our global team. And there we were looking at predominantly US, European names. And I was observing those drivers of outperformance that we saw there. And what we were trying to do was pinpoint the source of the success of those European and US companies and what those common fundamental factors were, those things that we could say actually were common to a lot of those different stocks. So now I've brought that process back. I run the UK fund with the goal of kind of trying to apply those common factors, but to the UK index, so the FTSE All Share and AIM, anything above £100 million market cap. And we're looking for companies that are sort of, you know, they're class leading. They tend to be trophy assets. They're not simply good enough for the UK. We're trying to raise the bar, find the sorts of names that might appeal to global investors if ever they wanted to look beyond the Mag 7. So the factors are quite quality based. We focus on cash flow, not just profit and dividend, which is a kind of UK obsession. We like balance sheet stability and flexibility. We like return on capital. We look for high earnings growth as well, high and stable margins, low leverage, and all of those things add up to high return on capital type metrics.
Good. I'm looking forward to digging through the next NVIDIA that you've found in the UK market there, because I think we'd all love to be able to get on the coattails of that one. In terms of that sort of stock picking, how has the portfolio performed, say, over the last 12 months or since October lows or even year to date?
Yeah, so, I mean, the UK market has been strong in the last 3 months, as you say, really strong. It's actually outperformed global markets. And we're not too surprised by that. We sort of thought that would happen maybe a little bit earlier than it has actually happened. But, you know, given very low starting valuations, a lack of ownership amongst global investors, you know, we hear a lot that the UK only makes up for 4% of the global benchmark now. So we kind of thought that even a small pickup in sentiment would actually have a big impact relative to other markets. And it's definitely happening. And we can kind of contrast what's happening in the UK with what's happening in the US. The UK economy is certainly seeing some improvements, while in the US, you know, lead indicators are just starting to turn down a little bit. The outlook on inflation looks quite good. We're definitely no longer the outlier here. You know, UK inflation is at 2.3% versus 2% for the Bank of England's target. That really gives them breathing room to cut in the summer. While in the US, you know, inflation looks quite sticky. The Fed is kind of rowing back on some of those more dovish statements. So we're not too surprised about that strength in UK equities, and we think it can continue from here. Positioning is very low. Outflows from UK assets haven't abated yet. You know, we've seen outflows since 2016. They haven't abated yet, although we can see some signs in the derivatives market, so futures call options, that actually traders are taking that first step towards increasing UK allocations. And actually,
Alexandra, on that one, are they buying? I haven't seen that. Are they buying call options? Are they the put call spread is actually sort of changing?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and that's usually the first sign that you see before people start buying cash equities. You see them, narrowing the puts versus calls, and then outright calls, and then you see hopefully cash, people buying cash equities. The outflow data again last week was very, it was very aggressive. But actually, within that, if you looked underneath that, mid caps are where any money that is coming into mid caps. So actually, mid cap flows in the UK were positive last month and have been kind of trending upwards since April. So I think that's quite interesting, and again makes sense. The FTSE 250 does tend to outperform once the Bank of England starts cutting rates. So I guess the data would favour mid caps from here. In our fund, year to date, mid caps haven't outperformed. So we've had that headwind. But actually, more recently, we've had some M&A activity, which has been very positive for the fund. One of our kind of longest standing holdings, Keywords Studios, was bid for by EQT, which is a Swedish private equity firm. Last month at a 73% premium. So, really nice fillip for the fund.
Yeah, well done.
Thank you. We actually added to the position in September when I think the multiple was really a kind of a record low. The market, I think, really second guessed itself into valuing Keywords, which is a very strategic asset in the video games space. They're the kind of picks and shovels play. It's the development outsourcer. They don't, make games under their own title at all. And I think the market really kind of shoots first and asks questions later in terms of that AI debate, where it was worried that companies like Keywords would suffer negative consequences from AI. But actually, we talked to management a lot and we saw that Keywords had been very front footed about, incorporating AI tools into its toolkit to to reduce costs for their customers. And we see that, in gaming, we've seen over multiple franchises, multiple years. Actually, it's a race to the top. It's not a race to the bottom. Gamers don't want to pay a couple of quid less for a less good game. They're happy to pay more for a richer gaming experience. We see that actually AI could be quite helpful. So we added to the position when it was on what we thought was a very attractive multiple, not thinking that it would be takeouts aren't kind of a big part of the investment case. But I think it could be a big part of returns from here going forward.
Yeah. Just on that gaming sort of sector, I noticed you got another stock in your portfolio, Team 17, and that had a bit of a bloodbath on its share price, probably about 6 months' time. And I just, given what you said, I suspect you probably picked up some shares on that one. But anyway, it's bounced almost 100% over the past 6 months. And I guess it is also falls into that sort of like potential trophy asset type, takeover target, because I think it's slightly different. In fact, it has its own titles, makes sort of a third, I think, or 35% of its revenues of its own titles, but does two-thirds sort of developing for for third parties. Bit of a crown jewel in the UK gaming sector. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because this certainly piqued my interest about 6 months ago. I should have bought some, but hey, it's one of those things I didn't in the end. But what's the latest on Team 17?
Yeah, well, I think you could be forgiven for not buying it. There was some uncertainty definitely at that point. And when a management team or a company that, as you say, is quite a crown jewel, has this amazing reputation for beating and raising, almost every time since it came to market, when they have a misstep, it definitely does knock your confidence a little bit. And it takes a bit of time to, kind of talk to management and get reassured around that. So for us, they slightly sort of moved away from what was their core competency. They're not AA or AAA game developers, as you say. They make sort of snackable games, we like.
Indies,
exactly. They're quite cheap to buy. My kids can play them in, a couple of hours rather than weeks to complete these games, like the, like the huge titles. They suck you in for weeks or months. But they sort of moved away slightly from their mantra, which was always to spend no more than £1 million developing games. And that way you reduce your title risk, which is what we really liked about it. But I think they started spending more money on developing games, and then they got caught in that very, very congested game release schedule that was happening last year when there were a lot of games out on the market. It was really hard to get particularly indie games, you know, to the top of the bestseller list. So they, you know, they had that misstep there. They've got a new CEO, a new chairman as well, who has history in selling his video game companies. There aren't many listed video game companies left in the UK because they tend to get taken out. As you see, they're kind of a crown jewel. But I think Team 17, you know, what I hear from management, they're reverting back to that model that really worked. This team hopefully won't, you know, get ahead of their skis. Their focus is much more on evergreen content, which is a really good way to drive your back catalogue. Mm. And that's really good for your valuation as well. So, yeah, I think lots more to come from these guys and from a kind of revamped, you know, corporate focus as well.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would also highlight to investors, it's got a pretty good balance sheet. It seems to have about 40 million of net cash. And it's only trading at about 14 times PE. So, yeah, I mean, that it isn't expensive, even though it's sort of doubled over the past 6 months. Now, if anybody wants to ask Alexander a question, please just put it into the chat bot, then I can read them out. We've had one actually over already previously, just asking about potential impact, just broadly on the UK sort of stock market of the general election. Now, people obviously a bit worried in terms of things might get delayed, particularly in public sector procurement while that's happening. Or alternatively, heaven forbid, we see a bit of the re-nationalisation syndrome. We've had that sort of like, you know, intimated with the franchises on the rails. What's your sort of like your view? Is it really just, you know, there's just a bit of noise and you've just got to accept that there's a bit of volatility, or is it sort of a bit more fundamental?
Yeah, I think we often kind of overplay the impact of politics on stock markets over the short term and the long term, actually. But the UK market has barely reacted, to be honest, to this this snap general election. You know, very few major kind of index or sector moves. And I think that's quite telling. I think, you know, the market's been expecting a change in administration, the Labour, this new Labour team is very centre focused. There's very little between their fiscal policies, between them and the current government. The investors, you know, don't seem to be too nervous about this change. And actually, I think it could be a clearing event. You know, we knew there was this election coming. It had to come before early 2025. So actually, the earlier, the better. By August, we could find we're in this position where we potentially have a new government without the kind of legacy, painful reputation and issues. And, you know, possibly some of that sort of patriotic rule Britannia kind of vibes that we had when the last Labour government came in. So, you know, we could have that plus an interest rate cut. You know, the mood in the market could feel very, very different by August. Mm. In terms of a kind of stock and sector specific read across, I think the biggest is probably in the construction, home building, building materials type market. One of Labour's five missions is to get Britain building again, which sounds a little bit familiar from across the pond. Freedom to Buy last week, which is sort of a bit like Help to Buy, I think. Mm. Names in our portfolio like Breedon, Volution, Howden Joinery, even a kind of Rightmove could benefit from this. We don't own any house builders. They would be the most geared into, you know, more positive government focus on increasing house building. But you know, we don't really want to invest based on any changes that you might get from a general election. That feels to us, you know, not as sensible as focusing on names with their own levers and, you know, diversifying models.
Yeah, it's just it's a temporary thing, isn't it? And you might get a bit of disruption in certain sectors, but in the if you're a longer term investor, it's probably just a bit of sort of a bump in the road or even a boost, whatever it comes down to. Just on that one in the building sector, I know you got sort of just Volution. We don't normally look at that a great deal. It's about about 870 million market cap, trades at about 15 and a half times PE. Does sort of like ventilation systems for houses and for buildings, sort of like I think it does extractor fans and heat exchangers and stuff like that. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because it's sort of a quite a quiet business on the exchange that doesn't really get a great deal of airtime.
Yeah, I think it should get a lot more. You know, 800 and whatever, nearly 900 million market. you know, it's coming up to that £1 billion cutoff. Mm. Really start looking at it. It has a small yield, one just under 2% yield, I think. As you say, they make energy efficient indoor air quality solutions. You and I would call that a bathroom fan.
Love it.
But they sell everything, you know, bathroom fans to kind of full heat recovery systems. And it's, you know, air quality is very much in vogue. It's very topical at the moment. Some very tragic outcomes that we've seen in the UK when mold is left unchecked. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, you know, a lot of very, very sensible and very sharp regulation in this area, particularly around social housing provision. So that's a nice kind of tailwind, that regulatory that regulatory piece is a nice tailwind, but it's got great geographic diversification. So this isn't just a UK play. And I think that probably escapes a lot of people with this one. It's only half of the revenues come from the UK now, 35% in Europe and 15% in Australasia. So that's given it a really nice balance. And when the UK is a bit soft, Australasia will pull ahead and, you know, in reverse. So the, you know, that resilience, that that kind of spread is something that we really like to see. And it's non-discretionary spend. You know, you can't really put off replacing ventilation products compared to other elements of refurbishment that can be postponed, you know, almost indefinitely. And I think that's why you see a difference between a Volution and a, you know, more general kind of Travis or kind of building product type company.
Yeah, they seem to have some pretty good pricing power, because, well, they must have, because their EBIT margins are over 20%.
Over 20%, return on invested capital nearly 30%. Yeah. The management team have done a super job. They had a new CFO in a couple of years ago who came from another large industrial company and has really, you know, done a super job in terms of margin, probably, you know, quicker than we thought was possible. So we're really impressed with that. And there isn't really a Volution equivalent in the UK. We would compare it to like a System Air, which is a European business. But yeah, we think that's, you know, we think there's a really strong outlook for organic growth plus some M&A as well. You know, they do bolt-ons.
Yeah. No, lovely company. Okay, let's move to another sort of like a trophy asset on the UK stock market. A bit smaller, just sort of 285 million. We've got Treatt, which does sort of like food ingredients or flavours and fragrances, particularly for the beverage sector. It sells them into sort of teas and coffees and fizzy drinks and stuff, orange flavours and all this sort of stuff. And it's gone through a bit the mill recently, but I think they've now got a new CEO who's just sort of started. And what was quite interesting, their last trading update, they had a bit of extra momentum. I think they did an H1 trading update, but they saw sequential growth and sequential improvement from Q1 into Q2. What's sort of your latest on this one? Because the margins are, you know, look as though they could go up about 13% currently, but you'd have thought for this quality of asset, it should be able to generate slightly more. And if it jumps the sales, what's the sort of the story on this one?
Yeah, we like Treatt. As you say, it's been on a sort of journey recently, and they've been on actually a much longer term journey over decades, from a citrus oil trading company to now a kind of flavors house with peers in Europe. You know, some of those very highly rated flavor and fragrancing houses. So now it's a manufacturer and supplier of a much more diverse portfolio of natural extracts and ingredients. So their focus is very much on that natural side. It's not, you know, it's not chemicals, and particularly they sell into the beverage industry, and the bits of the beverage industry that they really focus on is that kind of value add piece. So as you say, it could generate, you know, slightly higher margins, things like tea, coffee, so it's not as geared into citrus prices. They got a bit of ahead of themselves, a couple of years ago. As you say, they had an FX issue where they, you know, they didn't quite have the guide rails right on FX, which led to a profits warning. And then sort of rolling on from that, there was all the destocking issues that we've seen in the broader kind of chemicals industry. So, you know, they had to kind of cycle through that. But I think the benefit is they have, as you say, they've got a new CEO who's just started, and I'm going out to their site in Bury St Edmunds next month to meet him and look around the factory and, you know, see what's going on under the hood a little bit. But they also got a new CFO who came in from AB Foods, so, you know, perfect kind of CV to help Treatt out. And he has really tightened up FX, he's set some, you know, very achievable, what we think are very achievable margin targets. And they've started talking, you know, as you say, that trading statement, it was much more positive tone. They talked about order patterns normalizing, so the end of destocking, which, you know, usually is a great signal for a share price. And they talked about their March sales being the highest ever. So I think there's lots of sort of pent up, you know, latent improvement in there. What we like over the longer term is, you know, they're moving into coffees in China, flavored coffee, where it's a lot sort of sweeter. It's a much more sweeter flavor profile. The new site in Bury St Edmunds, which is much more, it's a fantastic site. It's more like a sort of a bar than a factory. So when
my kind of property to go to. Can I join you on your site visit?
I'm sure you can. They want to partner with their customers, so it's more of a kind of co-development agreement and arrangement rather than just straight manufacturing and supply. So much higher quality, much higher margin type business. I think they'll have a fully delevered balance sheet by September 25. They've learned from a lot of their mistakes. It's up almost 20% in 3 months, I think, partly to do with that, you know, that more positive tone.
Yeah, no, it looks like a bit of a cold spring to me. And as I say, with the new energy coming in from the CEO, then, I think with a fresh pair of eyes, they can get back to sort of like, you know, what they were delivering in terms of, you'd have thought he probably could, this sort of business probably could do high single digits, sort of low teens growth, organic. And I mean, I'd say 15% EBIT margins easy. But hey, you know, that's me. OK, I've got a question coming in from Daffodil. He's asking about Daffodil. That's a good name. He says, have you got any position in Equals, the payments, which I guess looking at your portfolio, you haven't. I guess no.
No, we looked at it at IPO, but we haven't dealt. We have a payments position in a company called Boku.
Yeah, what's the latest on this one? Because it's more of a sort of carrier, isn't it? And carrier payments. Is it Asia focused? And also, I think it does mobile wallets there as well. But it's showing incredible growth.
Yes, I agree. Amazing growth. So this is a sort of £550 million market cap AIM listed business. They've got net cash. They don't pay a dividend, and it's worth noting that it's incorporated in the US. So not all funds in the UK or investors can own this. It's just kind of worth knowing that. We really like this. The global payments industry is changing very rapidly. Conceptually, Boku isn't the easiest to understand because in our world, we think of Visa, MasterCard, putting everything on our cards. But actually, you know, most of the developing world is unbanked. They don't have a bank account. They use cash. And so if you want to create a subscription to, say, Netflix or Amazon Prime Video, and you don't have a bank account, that's quite difficult. You don't have a bank account, but you definitely have a mobile phone. So what Boku has done is signed up all these connectors between mobile phone payment, the mobile phone companies and merchants like Amazon and Netflix. So it allows a Netflix or an Amazon to access subscribers, which they wouldn't previously have been able to access given their, you know, given the payment setup. So it's called direct carrier billing, and it allows customers to put, you know, subscriptions or whatever on their mobile phone bill. That's what they've been doing. That's the kind of the history of the business. It's very high margin, cash generative. And what they're doing is using that to invest into digital wallets, e-wallets, a bit like kind of Alipay in China or GoPay in Indonesia. You know, these are the ways that people in developing markets pay rather than Visa and MasterCard.
And you presumably with those wallets, you can not only pay for Netflix and Amazon, but you can also pay person to person. If you've got sort of like, I don't know, if you want to give pocket money to your kids or you want to give your friends, you know, you've got to pay for a round or something like that, then it's account to account as well, isn't it, I guess?
Exactly. Account to account, you know, is a reasonably new style of payment method. But they've just signed up a couple of providers, UPI in India, Pix in Brazil. Boku act as the direct payment aggregator, for example, in India. They have 300 million, or UPI have 300 million active users, and they make 13 billion transactions every month. So feels like Boku is quite well set for this. And lots of people, you know, they face off against these huge companies, these huge you know, merchants as well as the payment providers. Amazon, for example, have warrants to buy 3.75% of Boku at 80p. They would only be able to exercise that warrant if Amazon put through $200 million dollars, cumulative through the business over 7 years. So that would be, you know, very meaningful upside from current guidance.
Mm. And I'm guessing with that sort of level of transactions, there must be a data mining opportunity there, because if you have people who are just using their mobile phone to pay, then you know what they're buying and on, or who they're paying. And on that basis, presumably you can do targeted ads and to do information and stuff like that for people who want to get, AI generated digital advertising or whatever.
Yes. And I think, you know, they've got a really interesting customer list, which includes, you know, Google, Meta, Microsoft, people like that. So I think there's, you know, what they've demonstrated is that they, you know, they can take, you know, one kind of key product and then use that to pivot into other areas.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's pivot again to back to that bar over in Bury St Edmunds. We've got Fevertree. I know it's a different company, but they do sort of like cocktail mixers for the sort of the, I don't know, spirits like gin and vodka and stuff like that. And what's quite interesting is that they now seem to be sort of like recovering from a sort of like a destocking. They've got, I think, the biggest markets now, the US outside of sort of the UK. But it's spirits have sort of like had this problem whereby you've had Diageo having a bit of a profit warning. You've had Brown and Forman, who makes one of the whiskies out there in the States. And I think you've had Remy Cointreau also saying they've suffered from destocking in America. So what's your sort of your latest on this one? Because it does seem to be bucking the trend. Mixers seem to be working, but hard liquor's a bit of a problem at the moment.
Yeah, well, you know, as their slogan goes, when three quarters of your drink is the mixer, they say mix with the best. But, you know, there's a different purchase frequency and quantum around your mixer versus your premium spirit. Yeah. So I think that kind of helps protect it a little bit. You know, we know the UK story here, phenomenal success. But actually, for me, the US story is actually incredible in Fevertree. They've compounded revenue at 20% over the last decade. As you say, it's now the largest division by revenue. It's overtaken the UK. They did 24% constant currency growth in 2023 in the US. Fevertree is now the largest premium mixer brand in the US. They're number one in tonic and ginger beer in the US. That's an incredible performance. But we think there's still a lot to go for in the off-trade, so, you know, where you buy your drinks or products in the supermarket, and then in the on-trade where you're in the bar. And the, you know, the US is just, it's 12 times larger, this category, the spirits category, than in the UK. So that kind of gives you a bit of an idea of how important this is to them. And I think you'll also get some margin accretion. You know, Fevertree is set to double EBITDA this year. And we'll get that margin accretion over the longer term on top of it.
And just on that margin, Alexandra, I mean, I see they do about just, well, they expect to do 12% EBIT margins, which does seem rather light for a quality branded drinks company. Where do the management team or you think that could get to? Because I thought it should be north of 15% ultimately, I'd have thought.
Yeah, they talk about getting back to kind of UK previous UK levels, which I think was around 30%. So there's a lot to go for with the revenue growth as driving well. So they're very glass led. You know, as a premium business, they prefer to sell their in those lovely glass bottles, either the small ones or the large ones. And glass price is very linked to the natural gas price. So when that, you know, really spiked in the summer of 2022, they and they're not, you know, they're not a huge customer yet for these glass manufacturers. So I think they were kind of further down the queue in terms of negotiations and supply. So they just kind of had to wear a lot of that increase in the glass supply, in the glass cost. And then at the same time, you know, transatlantic freight was, I think, 4x where it normally is in the summer of 2022 as well. So they had a lot of, hugely increased costs. I think they've done they've learnt a lot from maybe kind of dropping the ball a little bit there. They've locked in their pricing on transatlantic freight now. They've got a sort of a very strong head of procurement and operations, you know, type person to help them with these negotiations. They're taking price in the UK now. So there's, I think there's quite a lot to go for. They've broadened their categories as well. So I think this summer they're forecasting good growth from the Paloma drink, which sounds delicious. That's tequila and sparkling pink grapefruit, which was quite popular last summer as well. And they've also partnered with a French rosé producer to make it's called Rosé Spritz, and it's a rosé mixed with I think it's their raspberry and orange sparkling mixer, so you get a much lower ABV, you know, long summer drink, which, you know, is that lovely pink color. So that, you know, they're playing into the lower alcohol content as well.
You've got a question on just on Fever Tree from Nigel Batty Seams. He's basically asking, will there be a target for Coca-Cola or PepsiCo, as in, like, is it a natural fit for a bigger drinks brand?
Yeah, I think it is a natural fit. You know, over the years, Diageo have definitely been touted as a buyer. I think the soft drink producers are probably a more natural buyer, and they could come in and really help with that. You know, glass procurement, for example, the freighting, the distribution. I guess, you know, possibly they want to see more progress in the US from this business. But, you know, and Fever Tree, you know, it's always traded at quite a premium valuation to the rest of the beverages sector. But actually, at the moment, we see Fever Tree on kind of less than 3x EV sales, whereas like a Monster, who could be another, you know, definitely another interested party, the Monster energy drink people, that trades on closer to 6x sales. Yeah. So I don't think price would be a sticking point.
No, good. Okay, let's again on that sort of like the consumer side. We've got SSP, which basically does cafes and eateries in airports and seaports, and also into railway stations and stuff like that. Again, obviously had a bit of a nightmare during the pandemic when we were all locked down. But now that we've got revenge travel, I'm guessing it's having a bit of a boom. What's sort of your latest on this one? The margins are actually about 6%, which seems a bit low for this type of business. But how do you see it going?
Yeah, I think this is a story of, you know, a lot of capital being deployed at the moment on expansion and trying to really take market share and, you know, sort of land grab. But that full margin recovery as a result is kind of delayed for a couple of years. So, you know, that can be quite hard, challenging for equity investors to work through. We see the valuation as more than compensating for that. As you say, you know, it's kind of bouncing back from that, you know, the pandemic issues. Travel has become a lot more about experiences. It's a lot more leisure driven. 75% of SSP's revenue comes from leisure travellers. Mm-hmm. And typically they will get to the airport, you know, much earlier than, say, a business traveller. They're not going into the lounge. They're using the SSP concessions and outlets. You know, I'm always sort of annoyed when I get to the airport and find how much of a price premium I have to pay for my prep coffee and croissant in the morning. So SSP feels like a kind of good way to try and get some of that back.
Yeah.
I've got this huge CapEx program going on at the moment, as I said, and we do need that to bear fruit. You know, that is where once that some of that CapEx starts to roll off, then you start seeing that, you know, that capital, that cash generation coming through, the leverage coming down. They do have, they're 1.5x geared at the moment. But, you know, they maintain the dividend, so 2.3% yield, something like that. But we would like to see, you know, this CapEx program starting to bear fruit.
Yeah. Well, looking at the holiday bookings for this summer, they're going to have a roaring time in those airports, no doubt about it. What's quite interesting, actually, I mean, people are a bit like me, a bit of a cheapskate. So if you sort of travel sort of low cost economy, you know, you rather than buying an expensive meal on the plane, you go to nip into Upper Crust and get yourself a nice fresh baguette, and it's good. Okay. Yeah. Okay, let's move to the IT services sector. We've got FDM Group, which basically does sort of, I think it's lower level sort of IT consultants into businesses. It's struggled a bit, actually, of late, as people have sort of, like, corporates have decided to cut their budgets on IT and to save a bit of cost and stuff. What's sort of your latest on this one? The shares trade at roughly around about, well, it's a trough margins, but it's sort of 19x, I guess. They've got a pretty good balance sheet, though. They've got a lot of cash anyway.
Yeah, loads of net cash on the balance sheet. 8.5% yield, I think, at the moment. So that looks quite enticing. The CEO is the largest shareholder. He runs this business very prudently. This is his, you know, this is his baby. He absolutely loves this business and, you know, therefore runs it like an operator, not, you know, not a rental. So we really like that. The shortages of technology skills where FDM is operating, they, you know, they remain very acute. And I think that's a really supportive backdrop. But as you say, you know, this is a pretty tough point in the cycle. I think we're at trough earnings and actually only just off trough multiple, even though that sounds quite high. But for this kind of business, actually, that's quite troughy. We just heard from the CEO of a US mega cap enterprise tech company. And we were asking them kind of compared to like Salesforce and some of the sort of slightly weaker guidance that we've heard from some of those enterprise tech companies, you know, how do they see it? And they said, you know, they every day they're having conversations with the CEOs of major UK banks, for example, about just how much legacy software these banks are running in the business and the need to upgrade this tech in order to get the benefits from AI or, you know, any new technology. But I guess AI is sort of putting it into sharp focus. And to upgrade that tech, you know, you need help. You need Mounties, who are the consultants that FDM trains. So I think we'll see the market turn back into their favour sometime this year. The operational leverage on the upside is very strong as well. So we're kind of sticking in. It's one of those, you know, really well run businesses that it is cyclical.
Mm. How much the split is between sort of like, you know, corporates or, you know, the private sector versus the public government sector? I'm guessing it's what, two thirds, third or something like that?
I don't know the exact number, but it's mostly corporates. Yeah. So financial services are by far their biggest vertical. And that sort of makes sense why they had a soft patch in 2023. Actually, two of their largest customers kind of pulled back on in terms of how many Mounties they wanted in 2023. Yeah. That can have quite a big impact. But I think what's really positive is, you know, if a bank, for example, gives back the consultants to FDM, FDM's choice is either to make them redundant or to keep them kind of on the bench and wait for another deployment. And that's what they've done. So I think management can see these encouraging signals. They've signed these master service agreements with some large new customers, which is kind of like a framework. And then all we're waiting for is you know, just for these consultants to be kind of, you know, taken off.
Yeah.
So you've got lots of signals, lots of signs that that the recovery is coming. We just we can't say exactly when.
Yeah. What's another company in that sector which is bucking the trend actually is Byte Technology, and it's still growing really well. It's a value-added reseller, I think, largely of software. It does a bit of sort of like hardware, but in sort of security, cloud applications, probably AI, etc. And how come this one is sort of like doing so well? I mean, it trades at about 23 times, which is actually slightly less, I think, than Softcat. So it's pretty much in line with the market, but it does seem to be bucking the trend really well.
Yeah, they grow two times as fast as the market. I think part of what makes Bytes quite special is that 64% of what they sell is Microsoft product. So, you know, they are just kind of riding that incredible sweet spot. The premise for Microsoft is that Bytes, a bit like Boku, I guess, can connect Microsoft to thousands of clients in the UK. You know, they focus on small, medium-sized businesses in the UK that Microsoft otherwise would not be able to reach with their direct model. So they use resellers like Bytes to help them, you know, reach these new customers. Over the medium term, as you say, you know, the numbers look extremely strong. We should get double-digit growth in all their KPIs because, you know, the addressable market is just so big. Again, this isn't discretionary. You can stop procuring hardware. You can push out your PC, you know, replacement cycle a little bit if you want to, but you can't turn off the Microsoft Office tap. You know, everyone knows how quickly their world would unwind without Office. And then I think what's probably in the multiple now a little bit is that potential from AI, where, you know, management have been quite coy on this, which I like. You know, I like that they're not kind of talking this up massively. And they talk about a gradual transition as corporates get themselves AI ready. But, you know, Microsoft Copilot should be a really nice boost for Bytes.
Yeah, the implementation and the usage of it. Okay, good. We've got another question. Another question coming in from the audience. Paddy MHDB. And I don't know if it's a bit confidential, so I'm not sure you can add to this, but if you just a bit, but he asks about how's the Rathbones merger going with Investec, and has it sort of changed the DNA of the company? But I don't know what you can say there.
Well, I guess I can't say too much because I sit in the asset management division. So I suppose we sort of have limited involvement in how the merger's going. For me, the most impactful thing that is changing is that we're going to move office to the Investec Gresham Street office, which is lovely, very nice roof terrace. Yeah. So I think it's going quite well.
Good. Well, you'll be able to test those the Fever Tree products and also the flavoured teas from Treat, I think, which will be very nice. Okay, let's stick with the IT sector. We've got GB Group, which another is a really trophy asset on AIM, one of the larger companies. It's actually the share price has ticked up quite well after having a problem about sort of 2 to 3 years ago. It does sort of like ID, online ID verification, location verification as well to help e-commerce businesses make sales to people who are not physically present. So what's your latest on this one? Because they came out with a sort of like a inline trading update just of late.
Yeah, I mean, inline is pretty good for them in recent months, yeah. To be honest. And you explain it really well. I think, you know, even management have got a little bit lost in explaining this company recently. But yeah, we would see it as a leading expert in global digital identity. They're trying to make it easy for businesses to identify and verify who their customers are, what locations they're in, and to protect against fraud, both customers and merchants. Over half of UK businesses have been victims of fraud. I read a stat on that recently. So the demand for these identity verification products is huge. But they again got themselves in a bit of a twizzle. They bought a business called Acuant at the peak of the sort of crypto cycle in, I think it was November 21. And then suffered with 2 years of earnings downgrades because of its exposure to transactional e-commerce and crypto. So they've moved the CEO on. They've got a new CEO in who's actually an internal candidate. He runs their Asia Pacific business, which is, you know, always the kind of the star performer in the portfolio. So I think it's turning the corner, as you say, an inline trading statement. Actually, that's pretty good. We've had 2 years of downgrades. He talks a lot about the structural growth opportunity in the business, which, you know, we're fully bought into. And I think now it's about deploying the different technologies that GB has and trying to deploy them together, tie them together, growing in the US. And we like that message. We like the valuation, just over 3x sales. That's, you know, that's pretty low for, as you say, a trophy UK software asset. It is just under £1 billion market cap, I think, or maybe just under £900 million market
cap. Yeah, that's right.
AIM listed. It's got a bit of debt on the balance sheet, which we would like to see coming down. We prefer our, you know, software companies to not have too much debt, less than 1x, I think. So they need to, you know, show a path to deleveraging.
And they had a bit of M&A interest as well, didn't they, a couple of years back? So wouldn't be surprised if somebody puts a slider all over them again as the market. Because, I mean, gaming is turned. You've had crypto, which has turned. Gambling is going absolute gangbuster out in the States in terms of, and e-commerce is a secular growth story. So they've had all of those secular trends are still in place, I'd have thought.
They're still in place. Some of them, I mean, so when you think about crypto, for example, which was, you know, a lot of sort of partly why they got themselves in a muddle. But where GB Group operates is when people open a new account. So actually, if you're just kind of, you know, reusing a dormant account, actually that wouldn't help GB. So it's about new account opening. So you kind of need that, that sort of extra impetus.
Yeah, okay.
A new account rather than just business as usual. But then the e-commerce, as you say, that's much more transactional.
Yeah. Unless obviously you had AI, which is impersonating people. So you have to keep on rechecking to make sure it isn't a bot who's nicked your ID.
Yeah, exactly. And there's just huge demand for these cutting edge technologies. So they need to reinvest and make sure they're always you know, at the edge of these things. But, you know, very good point around M&A as well. Yeah. A bid, I think, in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a few words. Okay, we've got a question coming in from Javen Turner. He says, what is the most misunderstood company that you own, which you think has led to a mispricing? And I guess that's a pretty of a difficult question. We might come back to that, give you a chance to think, but anything off the top, sort of like the tip of your tongue at all?
Oh, that's a good, that's a very good question. Molten Ventures definitely stands out there, which is a listed venture capital company. So very unusual structure. Mm. In that it's listed and is a great way to for investors to access companies that stay private for longer. They definitely, you know, they've suffered from kind of the rapid increase in interest rates and all the sort of dampening effect that that's had on valuations in the VC space. They've got some really interesting assets in there, and I think investors, you know, lost faith in what the net asset value of this business is. So it trades on its net asset value. That's how you'd value a company like this. And investors had less faith that NAV was a true NAV. But actually now we've seen a couple of assets being sold at or around book value, which is, you know, just really helps to prove out their valuation. So the most recent NAV was 661 pennies. I think it currently trades on £3.35. So, you know, huge discount still in there. And I think as they can prove out those valuations, get some cash in from selling assets, from, you know, realizations. But, you know, most of their assets that they have stakes in, you know, they're fully funded for the next 12 months in terms of what they need for the businesses. So actually, I think it's in a really good place with they run their portfolio a bit like we do, as, you know, a portfolio with assets at different points in the cycle.
Yeah, no, and I think you raise a really good point, though. I highlight a really good point in terms of, you know, private market transaction values are significantly higher a lot of the time than the public ones, and you see that coming through the M&A in terms of, you get, is a keyword studios for a classic you mentioned at the start, you know, 70% premium, and you know, you suddenly see this huge sort of like uplift because somebody else can get so much more value. And I think that's where investors do lose sight. Actually, they get, you know, they get into their sort of relative value public sort of stuff, and they don't sort of like take a consideration of the synergies that somebody else could get if they actually buy these. And it sounds as though Molten Ventures falls into that category.
Yeah, and, you know, over time, we're going to work out who was right. You know, public market investors, we always think we're right. But actually, the valuations in the UK and the premiums that these companies that get bid for and get taken out are so big.
Yeah.
And those companies can make it work. And I think we'll see some of them. You know, I'd love to see, if the keywords bid goes through, I'd love to see EQT kind of combine that with another video game company that they bought a year or so ago, and then relist that in the public markets, and, you know, they would have serious market share. And so, you know, then we'll get some more, we'll have more clarity and more visibility on what actually goes on after the take private.
Yeah. Well, we saw that recently, actually, also with, I think it was Global Data who released, and we also had it with Marlowe as well. Now, just on that theme of potential sort of like unbundling, is it a value trap? Who's right? Or is it value play? Just to move to Future Group, because this is a really sort of like now a large sort of digital advertising publishing business. It has iconic magazines like Marie Claire, but also owns Go Compare, which has been, you know, benefited a lot from the cost of living crisis, because I think moneysupermarket.com's done pretty well. What's your sort of your latest on this one? The shares have rallied hard of late, but from a very low and depressed level. Incredibly, still only trade at about 9.5x PE. What's your sort of your view on this one? Because is there an unbundling opportunity here? Also, it just seems, if it is a value play, it's remarkably cheap. It's remarkably cheap.
Yeah, I agree. You know, when you look at the long term chart of Future, and if you sort of get excited about what it's done this year, that's fine. And then you look at the longer term chart and you can still see there's a long potential route back. It was a real market darling under the previous CEO, Zilla. She did a superb job moving it from a loss-making kind of print magazine business to what it is now, which is a digital media platform. But they've been they are kind of often at the mercy of those Google algorithm changes. Sometimes they benefit them, sometimes they don't benefit them. So last year it was difficult. This year, actually, the most recent algorithm change has helped them. They lost a bit of their audience, particularly in one of their websites called Tech Radar, because there's been a sort of lack of innovation, a lack of new products released, particularly by Apple. So that means that, you know, audience isn't on Tech Radar finding out the best headphones to buy or the best new iPhone to buy. I think we're at an inflection point now. You know, the results that they released a couple of weeks ago showed that they have returned to organic growth now and cash flow generation. They topped up their buyback, which is, you know, I think that really shows confidence. They've got this new CEO who's come from BuzzFeed. So, you know, a great hire, I think. And he, whenever it was a couple of weeks ago, he said, we're not doing any more M&A. So it's always been a, you know, an M&A story. You have this, you have the kind of the filter, and the view was always just to keep pushing more assets through the filter. And actually, he said, no, you know, when M&A is off the agenda for a while, we're focusing the portfolio on those three divisions. So you've got Go Compare, and then you've got B2C and B2B. Yeah. And he said, you know, there's no kind of sacred cows. We're looking at all parts of the portfolio. And, you know, the market really liked that, that there's a potential, again, a bit like Molten, for for independently verifying the valuation of some of these assets. You know, we can put a nice, easy multiple on Go Compare, similar to Money Supermarket, if you want to, and then back out some of the other divisions. I think they would rather hold on to Go Compare because it's got such great momentum in it, and I think there's still a lot more they can do in that asset. They might, you know, maybe they'd sell B2B, which would raise, you know, maybe 100 million or something like that. Mm. That's what we think the valuation, the value could come from. So one of those names that, you know, I think is definitely on the up. And as you say, still, in terms of its valuation, very reasonable. But, you know, people do get worried about AI and what happens to content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does sound, just the point you made at the start, it does sound as though we are going through an inflection point, not only on looking at the business with a fresh eyes, what's core, what's not core, what they want to keep and all that kind of stuff, but also, more importantly, the technology refresh with AI computers now already starting to hit the ground. You hear that from positives from Dell and Hewlett-Packard and all the other big PC makers, but also Apple's got its developer conference, I think, this week, and it's going to have a massive AI announcement. If it does, then it's going to be launching new phones because the existing AI line, sorry, the existing iPhone lineup can't cope with AI, can it? So you're going to have that huge hardware refresh.
Yeah, so that, and that innovation cycle, you know, really helps a company like Future as consumers want more advice and ideas on which products to buy. Yeah, so we're, you know, we're sort of excited about the possibility for turnaround and just a much more kind of market friendly capital allocation policy, I guess, around no M&A, portfolio rationalization, possibly buyback, and then, you know, reducing that net debt.
Good. Okay. Well, let's pivot to another sector. We've got healthcare, and this company, Advanced Medical Solutions, hasn't been reticent about doing MA. It just bought a big business called Peter Surgical. It does sort of like advanced wound management and healing products, and really sort of like, you know, patented technology, but it's really sort of like it's got lots of barriers to entry. It's well known, very well respected. Had a bit of a problem a couple of years ago in terms of the US distribution. Seems to resolve that, and then it just made this synergistic acquisition, which I think is, you know, put it to a bit of net debt. What's the latest on this one? Because it does seem to be another trophy asset in the UK market.
Yeah, I agree. You know, this is a again, an AIM listed, about 450, 460 million market cap, I think. A little bit of net debt on the balance sheet, very small yield. Mm. It's always been a very high multiple, high margin story. Medical equipment business, so they design, manufacture, they call it innovative tissue healing technology. You and me, I would describe those as surgical glues. Biggest and sort of most famous product, I guess. And they've just made this very big acquisition, as you say, Peter Surgical, and that puts them really very focused onto that surgical market. They also have a small wound care business, but it's looking less and less kind of core, I would say, at the moment. You know, the market reaction to the deal was I thought very strange. Investors have been asking them to spend that pile of cash for years, and the management team is incredibly conservative. Is a really detail driven, just cautious team who do so much work on an acquisition before they, you know, before they make it. So it's taken them a long time to get this deal, but it looks like a really good one. And now the market has decided that, you know, now it's got net debt on the balance sheet that actually they don't at. So, you know, they probably feel like they're damned if they do, damned if they don't at the moment. Yeah. But, you know, this is very high margin business, 20% kind of EBITDA. As you say, they've moved away from that distributor model in the US where they had a few problems, because that, you know, it makes you a bit vulnerable to your distribution partners. It means you don't have full control over where your product is going and pricing and all of those things. So they've done a good job, I think, in, you know, taking back control of that and segregating the market a little bit with a couple of much more incentivized partners who will help them with distribution. And then the Peters deal will help with that. When I spoke to management, actually what they said to me was, well, they sort of explained the footprint of Peters. So there's a huge amount of, I think there's a huge amount of synergies that they can get out of this deal. And typical of this management team, you know, they really undercook those to the public market because they want to be super cautious. They want to beat and raise. So I think they've undershot that and we'll be really pleased with the synergies that we see.
Yeah, I would agree. I think they're going to get a lot of operating leverage. And I mean, you look at their margins forecast is 17% EBIT margins. But frankly, I think they should be able to get easily 20% plus on this one, because it's a high value, non-discretionary healthcare product.
Yeah. And the glues, you know, the margin in the glues is much, much higher. We've been adding on this. We like this company and the market position that it has. And as they, you know, as they take back that market share, that's very accretive to me.
Yeah, Smith and Nephew have got a similar business, much bigger. So it wouldn't surprise me if there was a bit of joining funds. But anyway, wait and see. Okay, let's move to another company that's done a big recent acquisition, Bloomsbury Publishing. And I think that the long-time CEO there, Nigel Newton, has done a blinder here. He's basically bought a business out in the States, Roman and Littlefield, which is in academic publishing. I mean, as people, just as a bit of background, people probably know Bloomsbury for its Harry Potter and Sarah J. Maas sort of, like, you know, consumer type of fantasy books and stuff. But it also has got a good booming sort of academic and publishing, and also B2B. And this one falls into the academic side. Give us your latest thoughts on this one, because, again, they don't seem to have dropped, put a foot wrong at all.
Yeah, I mean, management, again, as you say, have done a super, super job. These guys are the Harry Potter publishers. You know, they've enjoyed that annuity stream. Harry Potter, the first Harry Potter book was published just over 27 years ago.
Crikey.
Yeah, it's very aging. And in 2023, I think it was still the fourth best-selling children's book. So, you know, the duration and the quality of this asset is extraordinary. And actually, I think we've got a TV series coming up soon, a new Harry Potter TV series, which about to watch, but also to see how it reinvigorates the book sales for Bloomsbury. As you say, they've got some other secret weapons. Sarah J. Maas, hugely. You can see actually a couple of hers on my bookshelf behind me. She sold 40 million copies of her sort of Harry Potter sort of wizarding type, fantasy, but more aimed at adults. Yeah. Super popular, particularly on BookTok, which is a corner of TikTok, actually quite a big corner, 10 billion clicks and counting, where people do a sort of, you know, short form book review. And they talk about the books and the genres that they like. And the genre that they like at the moment is romantic fantasy. And the author that they absolutely love is Sarah J. Maas. So Bloomsbury had to have a 30% positive profit warning earlier in the year. They upgraded FY 2024 revenues. They've upgraded for 2025 as well. They've doubled revenue and profit since 2020, which, you know, I think is amazing for what, you know, most people say is a no growth sector. I think probably investors got a little bit spooked by the management saying there wouldn't be a Sarah J. Maas release in 2025. but they, you know, they've re-released her latest book in paperback just at the very end of FY24. So I think that will support 2025 numbers. And you know, you kind of have to be really about your release schedule. We were, you know, we were looking excitedly at the net cash balance sheet, which we thought gave them, you know, strategic options, which they have now deployed. They've spent £65 million on Roman and Littlefield. Thank you. It's their acquisition. We spoke to management on the 4th of June, and they, you know, they talked about the great content that Roman and Littlefield have, 40,000 titles. So that'll take the combined business to just under 100,000 titles. So I think that's a really, it's a really solid kind of masthead for Bloomsbury. And the digital resources, Bloomsbury Digital Resources, which is the kind of final piece of the puzzle that got us over the line in terms of wanting a position in this stock, which is the new digital academic platform, which we're excited about. But again, management, you know, really keep it under their hats. They try not to kind of get the market too excited about it. But this is a more kind of software, software style part of the business. So, you know, again, different, different sort of margin characteristics there. So that, you know, that adds a nice little sweetener, I think, on top of the Bloomsbury investment case, which in and of itself is very strong. And I think, you know, surprises people when they actually look under the hood of what this management team have achieved in a supposedly no growth industry.
And also, you know, people, as you say, they buy the hardback or the the hard copy, they buy the soft cover, etc. And then invariably a couple of years later, they'll listen to the audiobook as well. So probably a few times.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of love the irony of, you know, of people going online onto TikTok to, you know, to sort of encourage other people to read a paper hardback book. It feels like we've sort of gone full circle.
Yeah, just download it on Amazon after they've read it once. Okay, let's move to another sector. We've got AB Dynamics, which basically does testing and of sort of like vehicles, automotives, etc. And the shares have performed really, really well. They're on about 31 times PE. I guess they're being boosted by sort of secular growth in regulation, more testing, safety of vehicles, but also increasingly driver-assisted systems, whether that's the forthcoming, hopefully, the, you know, autonomous, but also sort of like, you know, viewing and listening and just all that kind of and braking and all this sort of stuff. What's sort of your latest on this one? Because it's had such a good run. You'd at some point in time, and being a value investor myself, you'd sort of say it's just top slice. But have you sort of, have you sort of viewed this one? Because it is a, is this a run the winners or how do you see it?
Well, kind of as a rule, we, you know, my style is to run the winners. And that's definitely what I learned when I was running Global Money. But actually in the UK, there is a little tweak where, you know, something like a future is a great example of where, you know, some funds are, you know, it was like 10% of some of those big mid-cap funds. And then, you know, something small changes, like the Google algorithm, for example, and before you know it, the shares have halved. So for me, actually, portfolio balance is quite important. So we tend to kind of top and tail a bit more than used to, maybe in
that's the sizing side of it.
It's the sizing side, exactly. And you know, liquidity and you know, even if you're not having it out or redemptions, you know, other people might be. So you have to be a bit careful. And actually that helps with something like Bytes, which, you know, we talked about how strong that structural position there is and you know, what a great business it was. And it was actually over 2023, it had been tracking the Microsoft share price one for one. So it felt like one of those, you know, sort of gotcha moments when people say there's no tech in the UK, there's no way to play AI. And you say, oh, look, you know, look what Bytes has done. So we were feeling very pleased with ourselves, very smug about that. But we had to keep top slicing it because it was sort of butting up against limits. And, you know, it would have been easier to kind of say, oh, well, this one's a bit special. This it's different this time. We'll let that one run up. But we didn't. And then one day in February, we woke up to an RNS saying that the CEO had resigned because he'd been, you know, day trading his shares and that, you know, the stock was down 15%. So I think, you know, that just kind of reminds us why you do want to be a bit more position size aware in the UK, particularly. AB Dynamics, really interesting company, not super easy to kind of conceptually explain, but I spend quite a lot of time on their website where they've got some really good videos. And if you're a bit of a petrol head, it's excellent. And a site visit down really, really good. So 500 million AIM list, net cash on the balance sheet, I think. Very
yes.
You know, this is a growth company. They do advanced testing and measurement products, which they sell to the world's top automotive manufacturers. So tier one suppliers, service providers, they've got, you know, all the kind of top OEMs on the list, Tesla, you know, Land Rover, all of those kind of people. So they have, you know, very close relationships with the OEMs who really see them as their testing partner. But they also are on various sort of advisory channels with the regulators. So they've got good visibility over the requirements that are coming. And so they can, you know, they can be a really good partner to the OEMs because they'll be, you know, they'll be on top of those things. Regulation, as always, is a huge increasing all the time. Euro NCAP tests, for example, are to increase from just under 600 per vehicle in 2023 to 700 per vehicle in 2025. And there'll be more by 2030. Road deaths in the EU are falling, so the regulator feels like these standards are working. Road deaths in the US are actually increasing. And so we're seeing, so whichever way it happens, it leads to more regulations. Whether road deaths are falling or increasing, it seems to lead to more regulation. The US regulator is mandating automatic emergency braking, which is one of those key ADAS functions, which really underpins demand for the testing and driving robots, which ABD supplies. And previously, unbelievably, the US market was kind of unregulated with respect to emergency braking, which is quite surprising. So, you know, this regulation, this isn't like kind of consumer product testing. These regulations have to be followed in order for vehicles to be sold in the US market. So, you know, hugely strong demand kind of drivers in there. They've done a little bit of M&A as well. They've a little acquisition which is focused on EVs specifically for US-based car companies, testing EV batteries. I think this is really interesting, at temperatures between 30 and 50 degrees, because EV battery range, you know, gets hammered at different kind of temperatures, colder temperatures. And I think one of the reasons, you know, they're doing a really good job managing their margin in terms of kind of price rises. And they've also found some efficiencies. They have the absolutely super CFO who we followed from a couple of companies because she's just so good at managing the financials. And I think that's, you know, she's very good at under-promising and over-delivering and, you know, delivering margin and cash generation. And I think that's partly why the shares, you know, that's the kind of, that's the other side of the coin from delivering that fantastic growth, is knowing coming with very, very sensible financials.
Yeah. And I think rather than being cyclical growth, this is secular growth, isn't it? In terms of the regulation and the new technologies, autonomous driving and all this sort of stuff. Cars, you know, increasingly need to be safer. And there's so much new tech coming in that you have to test to make sure it doesn't degrade the safety or the quality or whatever like that. So.
But the auto sector is, you know, obviously very, very cyclical. And so can be managers like me who like a kind of quality structural business to own. But as you say, when you're in the testing side of it, actually, it is just, it's the regulation that drives it, not really consumer demand. You know, you have to test the car. It doesn't really matter how many people then buy it.
Yeah. Just on that cyclicality of the automotive industry, we did chat last time, I think it was Dowlais, which basically does CVJs, basically constant velocity joints, traditional, the old GKN automotive business that's moving into e-drive. So not just doing the internal combustion engine drivetrains, but also doing the now the EV side of it. And I think probably it's had a bit of a sort of like a sort of softer patch, given the automotive sector is a big ticket item in a cyclical downturn. Well, it isn't a downturn, but it's just sort of like stopped growing. And then you've had EVs not growing quite as fast. What's sort of your latest on this one? I don't know if you've sort of trimmed it or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not thrilled with this one. It's you know, performance hasn't met our expectations, kind of operation, let alone the share price. We didn't really anticipate this kind of playing out like this. They told the market in May, I think, that they're expecting negative revenue growth in 2024 and flat relative to 2023. We were expecting some growth. You know, it's difficult. They've spun, as you say, they spun out of Melrose. It's the old GKN auto business. There's a nascent hydrogen business in there as well, which is involved in metal hydride storage. So, you know, that could be interesting.
Yeah.
But small, it's difficult. You know, they have had to pivot away from the GKN management process, which was growth at any cost. You know, that really was the mindset. So what that's delivered to them is a fantastic market position. You know, they're on one in every, that Dowlais products are on, well, GKN products are on one in every two cars. So, you know, they have an amazing market position. It's the architecture that drives wheels, so side shafts, offs, that kind of thing. I think investors are nervous about the EV transition, how that works, but actually more kind of, you know, more at the sharp end at the moment, it's that cyclical softness in global light vehicle production. So we're not, you know, we're kind of not thrilled with how that's played out. It's got quite a lot of debt on the balance sheet. They were handed a lot of debt post the Melrose out. But it now trades on less or around 3x EV EBITDA, which sounds incredibly low, but, you know, auto, these kind of auto names don't trade on huge multiples at the best of times, but that still is a massive discount to their peers. And they've just initiated a buyback. And as we've seen in the UK market, that can be quite, you know, powerful for share price, you know, in terms of share price direction, particularly on a, on something that's, you know, that's had a really tough time. So I think we kind of retain a watching brief there.
Yeah. Well, they're always being touted as a potential takeover target from the likes of BorgWarner or Dana or somebody like that who wants to get in, you know, to get more into sort of those type of traditional components. Okay, well, let's go to a sort of finish off on another excellent trophy asset, Oxford Instruments. And this one has always been a company that I've admired and love it. It basically does scientific instrumentation for R&D and for companies, high value items. But I've never had the guts to be able to buy it at sort of like the valuation. But take us through your view on this one, because it never comes down in valuation. Everybody seems to like this business.
Fingers crossed. I'm always nervous. I'm always nervous talking about a company the day before it. Results.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Yes. I don't want to tempt fate.
All right. So we don't want to tempt fate. And actually, it's even more exciting tomorrow. It's the sort of presentation of the kind of strategic update from the new CEO. So the old CEO, who did a superb job with this business, retired last year. And they've got a new CEO in from, he used to run another UK industrials business. So we know him a bit. Oxford Instruments was the first technology business to be spun out of Oxford University. It provides those kind of cutting edge products serving very critical tech areas. So essentially it will allow companies, but also a lot of scientific, you know, researchers to image, analyze and manipulate materials down to the atomic and molecular level. So it's, you know, it's way above my pay grade. All three Nobel Prize winners for science in 2023, so that's medicine, chemistry and physics, all three of them used Oxford Instruments equipment in their groundbreaking research. I think that you know, it shows the kind of the, you know, what is going on within this business and how important it is. We like its end market exposures as well. They're in areas like quantum technology, healthcare, life sciences, you know, very, very positive outlook there. Advanced materials, also space, which is probably kind of more interesting to talk about, but actually now it has some growth in it as well. These end markets are kind of, you know, they're usually low to mid single digit growth, and then Oxford Instrument grows above that. And because we also quite like the fact that they're kind of 50-50 in terms of academic, you know, those scientific researcher customers and then the commercial customers. So 50-50. So that, you know, that gives a little bit of resilience. They've just been through this big CapEx program. So a £75 million that they've spent on a compound semiconductor facility in Bristol. And that starts, I think that starts operations this year. So they've been through that big CapEx program. So hopefully we'll see, you know, organic revenue growth and margin accretion over time from there. They've got net cash on the balance sheet, which gives huge ability to spend on CapEx programs like that, but also to maybe do some M&A. And it's quite unusual for industrial companies like this to sit on net cash. And they were bought by Spectris, I think, a couple of years ago, which kind of highlighted the value on offer and I think really reminded the market of what is in this. So, you know, if Oxford ever did derate, I do think it could be vulnerable. But it is, you know, it's a real it's a real trophy asset for the UK.
Yeah, no, it's certainly one with, if it did derate, I'd back the truck up on it because it's such a high quality company.
It's a bit like Halma and names like that, you know. Yeah. In the fund, what we try and do is when, you know, if the market, if there's like a general market dislocation, if everything's on sale, we would rather buy, you know, the highest quality thing that maybe we couldn't afford to before. And that's how we were able to start positions in Halma and Oxford, actually.
Yeah. That's a really good strategy. Taking the opportunity for a sell-off to upgrade the quality of your portfolio makes a lot of sense, no doubt about it.
But, you know, normally when you come out of those sell-offs, it's the, you know, it's the trashier end of the market that that rallies hardest. So it can be more tempting to try and to try and kind of juice your performance like that. But actually, then you're left with another decision. You know, when has that trash rally gone as far as it should? Now I've got to get out, find something else. Actually, we'd rather just kind of make one decision to buy those companies that we never thought we'd be able to afford.
Yeah. So I guess you haven't bought GameStop last week when Roaring Kitty was bidding it up.
I'll leave that to you.
Okay. Well, a big thanks to the audience for all those questions. And even bigger thanks to Alexandra for taking through those excellent stock insights and ideas. And I'm looking forward to seeing the results for Oxford Instruments and a few others over the next few weeks. So thanks again, Alexandra, and look forward in chatting in about 6 months' time.
Fantastic. Thank you, Paul. Great run through.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.